This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today I'm joined by a very special guest, Simon Brookyard, for the JodBite. Welcome to the JodCast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And in two words, why would you guess you are here?
Brains and beauty.
Both are true. But they weren't the two words I was looking for. Could you guess again?
Possibly pulsars might
yes,
be one of them.
That is one of them. Yes, excellent. So you're a pulsar astronomer.
I am indeed.
And a PhD student at the University of Manchester.
Yeah.
So could you very quickly give us a brief overview of what pulsars are? Because we've heard about them over the last 2 months, I think. We've heard that you can use them to detect gravitational waves and that you can use them to look at accretion and that sort of thing. And then could you tell us why so many people look at pulsars and study them in such different ways?
Well, very simply, and you get a neutron star when you take a medium mass ordinary star, maybe about 5 to 8 solar masses, and then it undergoes a supernova explosion at the end of its normal life, and the core region collapses down into a ball of neutrons, basically. I mean, it's very, very dense stuff, maybe about the size of a city, but with more mass than the solar system compressed into that volume.
So they're really extreme objects. And pulsars are emitters.
Yes. So we can see, we observe pulsars in, well, all across the electromagnetic spectrum, really. Mostly in the radio, but also in gamma rays, in X-rays, occasionally even at visible wavelengths.
And so, they behave a bit like lighthouses, which is why they're called pulsars.
Yes. So we get beams of emission from the neutron star. And as the neutron star rotates, which is very rapidly, I mean, some of them can rotate with periods of only a few milliseconds. And every time one of those beams sweeps across the Earth, then we see a flash of emission, like you would with a lighthouse.
And we've had two pulsar astronomers here recently talking about pulsars on the JodCast. Caroline D'Angelo, who was talking about looking at accretion, and James McGee, who was telling us how you might be able to use them to detect gravitational waves. So loads and loads of people study them in loads of different ways. What is it that makes them so interesting?
What makes them really interesting is that they are the most extreme laboratories that we have for a wide range of areas of physics. So, as you just said, people look at accretion for them. We can use them to look for gravitational waves. They are the most extreme electromagnetic fields that we know of in the universe. So a typical pulsar will have a magnetic field which is perhaps a billion times stronger than the strongest magnetic fields we have on Earth.
And far stronger than we could ever create.
Oh, much more so, yeah.
And on the topic of these magnetic fields, neutron stars are mainly neutrons, so they don't have any charged particles flowing around inside them or anything. Or I'm guessing not. You'll see why I'm guessing this in a second. Why is there a magnetic field at all? Do people know yet?
That's very much an area of debate.
Okay.
No one really knows 100% what is going on inside the neutron star.
Mm.
There are lots of different theories. So one possibility is that there is some sort of what is known as a dynamo mechanism generating the magnetic field, which is quite how that would work is a bit uncertain, because we don't know what sort of flows of particles we might get inside the neutron star. As you say, if the neutron star is made of neutrons, then they aren't charged particles and so shouldn't generate a magnetic field. But then one thing that should be the case is that if you have a big ball of neutrons in this situation, then at any given moment there should be some neutrons decaying into pairs of protons and electrons, possibly.
Okay.
Which will then recombine at some point to form another neutron.
Mm.
But at any given point, there are likely to be some free charges somewhere in the neutron star.
Mm.
And also, well, some theories state that the crust of the neutron star, for example, might be a lattice of nuclei of elements, rather than it being a large ball of neutrons all the way to the surface. Some people have suggested that the crust could be, for example, a lattice of iron nuclei or other heavy elements. which then would contain protons. So no one's really quite sure where the magnetic field comes from.
It's still a working theory.
It is.
But they only have recently been discovered within the last 50 or so years, isn't that correct?
Yes, the first one was discovered in 1967.
Ah. So yeah, almost 50 years exactly.
Yes.
Excellent. And the magnetic fields have a big effect on the emission of pulsars, and this is something that will directly affect your work.
Yes.
So could you give us a brief overview of what it is that you study and why it's so interesting?
So my work has focused on looking at pulsars at radio wavelengths, and in particular looking at the polarization of that radio emission.
Okay. Can we do some very quick jargon busting? What is polarization?
Well, there are two types of polarization. I focus principally on linear polarization, which is where, so an electromagnetic wave is an electric field and a magnetic field at right angles to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So in a linearly polarized radio wave, the electric field is always in a particular direction for that wave. So if we look at a linearly polarized radio wave, that gives us clues to, for example, the direction that the magnetic field is in at the point where the emission was generated.
Mm. And do we know where the emission is generated yet? Is it coming from the surface, or is it coming from just above the surface?
So the leading theories have it, is that the radio emission originates close to the surface, not at the surface of the neutron star, but very close to it.
And what is it that causes this emission in the first place?
So we start with charged particles in what we call the magnetosphere, which is essentially just the magnetic field outside the neutron star.
In the same way that the Earth has one?
Yes.
Only far more extreme.
Yeah. So within the magnetosphere, there will be charged particles which are accelerated by the magnetic field. And if you have an accelerating charged particle, you will get photons emitted. And those photons that are emitted at that point are high energy photons, so gamma rays. But they then undergo a physical process whereby they decay into a pair of particles. You get an electron and a positron. So those two charged particles then are also accelerated by the field, and you get more photons emitted and more particles generated. And so you develop a plasma within the magnetosphere, and that plasma somehow generates the radio waves through some form of coherent emission process.
Mm.
So my work is focused on trying to shed some light, as it were, on the nature of how we get the radio waves.
Oh, fantastic. And how long have people been looking at this? This is quite a puzzle. How long have people been working on this for?
Since pulsars were discovered.
Mm. So these jets of radio emission, do they come from particular points on the star? I know they come from either end of the neutron star. Do they come from a sort of magnetic pole? Or?
Yes, exactly. So the radio emission region is taken to be around the magnetic axis. So we get a very narrow beam of emission over each magnetic pole. So particularly what I've been working on is trying to determine for a set of particularly young energetic pulsars where the magnetic pole is in relation to the rotation axis in particular, and also where our line of sight from Earth passes as the neutron star rotates relative to where the rotation axis is and where the magnetic pole is. So essentially, which bit of the radio beam our line of sight samples.
And how many pulsars do you look at on a regular basis to try and work this out? Do they all behave in the same way?
So I've been looking at around 50 young pulsars, and there's a wide range of things that happen. But there are key techniques that we can use. So, for example, the polarization of the radio waves changes as the pulsar rotates. So we see a regular cyclic pattern of polarization as the neutron star rotates, which we can use to determine the structure of the magnetic field and also its alignment relative to our line of sight, and also from how it varies as the pulsar rotates, we can use that to try and constrain how inclined the magnetic field is to the rotation axis. All these things affect the polarization that we see, and it's my task to look at the polarization and to try and work backwards to see what is happening physically at the neutron star.
Sounds like really interesting stuff. And you're writing up your thesis now for your PhD, is that correct?
Well, I submitted some weeks ago.
Congratulations. So
thank you.
So and you're awaiting your viva.
I am. I have my viva next week.
Oh, good luck. I'm moving on from something dense to something denser when I make it anyway. Can you guess what the other reason that you were commandeered for this podcast was?
I'm going to guess that it's porridge.
Yes. So you were recently crowned world porridge-making champion.
I was indeed.
In some circles, you might be seen as a bit of a celebrity.
Maybe.
Sadly, we didn't get the first exclusive interview with you. I think the BBC snatched you first. Is that right?
Yes, they got me before I'd even made it back to Manchester.
Fantastic. We should have been there with microphones ready. So tell me, when was it that you first started competitively cooking porridge?
It was, so this year's competition was the seventh year that I've been to the World Championships. So, it's been something that I've done for quite a while now.
So you're a cereal porridge maker.
Oh.
Tell me about these championships. How long have they been going for?
This year was the 22nd World Porridge Making Championship. It is very much a world championship. This year we had competitors from all over the globe, really. We had four different competitors from Scandinavia. There was someone from Switzerland, someone from the Czech Republic. We had a chef from South Africa. There was someone even over from Oregon in the States.
Wow.
So it's very much a
coming from all over.
Yeah.
Where is it usually hosted? Is it usually hosted in Manchester?
No, it's hosted in a little village called Carbridge up in the Scottish Highlands, up in the Cairngorms.
And the prize for winning is the prestigious golden spurtle.
It is.
Which we do have on the table right now. Could you quickly tell us, so what is a spurtle? Because I remember our presenters were a bit confused by it and had to look it up on Google when they first talked about this news article.
So a spurtle is the stick that you use to stir porridge.
Mm.
So usually made of wood when it's not a trophy. And the idea is that with a wooden spoon, it might be more difficult to get into the corners of the pan, maybe, and you can get oats collecting in the bowl of the spoon. So with a spurtle, it's all convex surfaces, and it's a lot easier to stir the porridge well.
Excellent. Can you show me a little bit about the competition itself? How did it work? Was it one day, or...?
Yes, so it takes place all on one Saturday up in Carbridge. So there are two competitions. There's the traditional porridge, which you're awarded the golden spurtle for if you win. There's also a speciality competition in which you make something porridge-based.
Okay. And did you take part in both of these?
Yes, I did. We start the day with, first of all, a parade from the eponymous bridge in Carbridge to the village hall where the competition takes place. It's a really nice thing, really. You have a pipe band and all competitors walk along with their aprons and spurtles at the ready. Then there are four heats. There were four heats this year, five people each. And during the heat, you cook your traditional porridge and your speciality porridge. Those are taken through to a panel of judges.
How many judges?
Four judges. So your porridge and speciality porridge are taken through to the judges to be judged in private. Then after everyone has cooked in the heat, the judges decide on, this year it was six finalists for the traditional porridge. The speciality competition is judged just on what you make in the heat.
Mm.
But then for the traditional porridge, you cook again in the final.
Yeah. And the rules as to how you cook the porridge are very strict, aren't they?
Yes. So for the traditional competition, you're only allowed oats, water and salt.
And am I right in saying that you can only stir in a particular direction as well?
Yes. So tradition has it, you must stir with your right hand in a clockwise direction. Otherwise, you will invoke evil spirits.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So is that an old tale from that part of the country?
Yes.
Wow. And you mentioned that this was the seventh that you'd attended.
Yeah.
And you've been runner-up before.
I've been to the final the previous 2 years. Mm. This is the first year that I've won.
Congratulations. So are you going to hang up your apron and your spurtle now, or are you going to take part again next year?
I've got to defend my title next year.
Yeah, I like that. That's what I want to hear. Has anyone won 2 years in a row before?
It has been done. Not for a while, so maybe I could do that again.
Oh, here's hoping. All right. Thank you very much for the interview.
You're welcome.
It's been a great mixture of things. Cheers, Simon.